Well, we are going to spend a few weeks on in Proverbs, and we'll come back to the Proverbs later on throughout the year, off and on. But last year we looked at the first 9 chapters in Proverbs, which are not what we typically think of when we think of Proverbs. We usually think of short, pithy statements that have contrast in them. And those first 9 chapters are more teaching sections, whole chapters about one subject. But starting in chapter 10, it's those individual proverbs. But they're grouped together often in ways that bring some similarity to a whole group, or some perhaps there's several of them that have a related theme. There's a couple of ways to study Proverbs. One is to do it very thematically, where you just take a theme on speech or parenting or wealth or whatever, and just pull out all the proverbs that relate to that and study them in that topical manner. We'll do that in part at times. We'll pull out other ones, but in general, we're going to go through them in successive order through here. In chapter 10, verse 1, it says, the Proverbs of Solomon, which goes back to the same kind of heading that the very first first 9 chapters were titled. And it seems to be just a restatement at this point of this general idea of Proverbs, where the first 9 were really establishing this whole framework for wisdom, and now we start on those individual Proverbs. It's a restatement of Proverbs. The first 9 chapters are very specific about parenting. It's Solomon and his wife, in their role as parents to their son, and that education. This one follows that to a certain degree, but it becomes broader than that. It's not that succinct, but yet it has that same application at various places. So tonight we want to look at these first 5 Proverbs. A wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will reject the craving of the wicked. Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich. He who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully. As we look at this first proverb in verse 1, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. It would be a mistake there to see that as that the father gains some pleasure over his son that does well, but it's only and the mother doesn't, but it's only the mother that has this grief. That would be mistaken to see it that way. It's just using these parallelism. There's a similar one in 15:20. It says, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish man despises his mother. Also in 17:25, a foolish son is a grief to his father and bitterness to her who bore him. So 17:25 is the most the closest parallel. There's some others about wise son, though, in Proverbs. It says 13:1 says, a wise son accepts his father's discipline, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. 23:24, the father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who sires a wise son will be glad in him. 27:11, be wise, my son, and make my heart glad, that I may reply to him who reproaches me. And then in the very first part of 19:13, it says, a foolish son is destruction to his father. But if you look at 9:12 says, if you are wise, you are wise for yourself. And if you scoff, you alone will bear it. Kind of an unusual biblical teaching in terms that it puts a person kind of in isolation. But it really is in a sense saying that, the choices you make in life clearly affect you. And so there's in 9:12, it's that focus, that truth that you are responsible for your decisions. But here we move on. It says, while one's choices clearly affect his life, and therefore the wise recognize this and make decisions accordingly, one's choices also affect others. So 9:12 give one half of the truth, if you would, and this one brings the other half. You're responsible for your choices, and in that sense, your choices most profoundly affect you, but they also impact the lives of others. So here in 10:1, the contrast is not so much between the joyful and grieving parent as it is between the honor and shame that comes to parents based on the choices the children make. So if you see here, a wise son makes a father glad, and a foolish son is a grief to his mother. It's this whole idea of honor and shame that parents, that are reflected on parents because of the actions of their children. Now, those kinds of things are both true and then can be those things that are overstated if you're not careful. There's something true about the fact that decisions children make reflect upon parents, and the parents will feel either honor or shame. But then there's that point where parents take that to an extreme at times, and especially it seems very prevalent in the society we live in now, of trying to live their lives through their children often, and going, taking it out of this balance to putting all this pressure and responsibility on children that are beyond their age or what is wise or even in their interest. So this isn't in that, looking at it in that sense of where somebody decides that their three-year-old is going to be, the next greatest golfer, and, so it requires them to hit the golf ball 8,000 million times a day because they believe that, by doing that, that's why Tiger Woods became Tiger Woods. That would be going in a totally different direction here. But there is still something true about the positive decisions and responses of children reflect positively upon parents, and the negative ones reflect poorly. Now, it would also be true in Scripture that you can point out that people, as children grow up, that adults, that they are responsible for their own decisions, and that there's a limit to what parents can do. So we're talking about generalized truth here. So it would be a mistake to always look at a child's action and say, therefore I can accurately conclude that the parents did a poor job. Well, no, that's not necessarily true, because you have individuals that make decisions, sinful decisions, rebellious decisions. But with Proverbs, we talk in general terms. And the thing is, even if it's not true that the parents are truly responsible, there still is a sense that this is true, that a wise son makes parents glad, and a foolish son gives parents grief. And that one holds true in many times throughout life. I remember very clearly at this point, and when we were still living in Texas, and I was in the Rotary Club. It was through a couple of people in the Rotary Club and then one family in our church, that their adult children, and by adult children I don't mean 22-year-old children, I'm talking about 45-year-old children, that brought such grief to their lives because they were just incapable, it appeared, to live productive lives on their own. One was a family that came to our church. Their adult daughter, had grandchildren that was teenagers now, and their mother is an addict, and they're always doing something to try to help her, but not enable her. But they have this, daughter that's in her 40s that's an addict, and they're, and you start seeing, that kind of grief continues. It may not be a direct reflection of what they did as parents, but it is a direct impact on their life at that point. The contrast here is between that sense of shame and honor. Somebody said that the choices you make may be lonely, but they are never totally private. They're never truly private in that regard. You know, we live in a society, politically at least, where we have all these private decisions. You know, these are my private life projects. But there is, that's true. You know, those decisions you make, those choices you have to make, may be lonely in making them, but they're never really private. Old Testament scholar Derek Kidner writes, talking about the unmerited suffering that could occur here, says, without the ties at their best, the love, by which people are members of each other, life would be less painful, but immeasurably poorer. So if you could just divorce yourself from every other relationship, from all relationships, your life would have much less pain in it. But it would be a very poor life as opposed to a rich life. So part of relationships, come those hurts. The second verse says, ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. Well, once again, remember Proverbs, we're talking about some general truths, and we have to think about how we're going to understand these. Do you profit from ill-gotten gains? Do you profit if you steal something? Do people that take things that don't belong to them, do they profit? In the temporal, they may greatly profit. If somebody robs a bank and gets away with it, they've profited in the short term. So there may be temporal settings that there's advantages to financial gains that are made immorally. But in the long run, especially when compared to righteousness, there's comparatively no profit. Moral shortcuts to acquiring wealth do not offer true security or long life. In fact, just the opposite is produced. Righteousness implies, not on the, here in contrast, righteousness would be almost a synonym for honesty here, but righteousness here also looks at that relationships, the presence of the Lord, Yahweh, which is introduced very directly in the next passage when it says in verse 3, the Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger, but he will reject the cravings of the wicked. Once again, this is a general truth. It's not a promise that the righteous will never encounter troubles. However, that the righteous will not suffer hunger that comes from God somehow obscuring their cravings. The trouble that comes to those who get caught in their ways, that is, the wicked here, it says God will intervene and thwart their desires, their cravings. But God never comes in and thwarts the righteous desires of righteous people that thus puts them in a position of being hungry. But there are times, for a season of life, that righteous may experience periods of lack, where they, have a shortage of something. But in the finality, God provides for the righteous, but it is the wicked that he withholds from. He withholds their cravings. The contrast between the desires of the righteous and the wicked is what's contrasted in this. Desires lead to life or death, and so it becomes ultimately, what intention is guiding us? Are our desires aligned with the righteous, or are our desires aligned with the wicked? Which is guiding us? Bruce Waukee, an Old Testament scholar, says, what the wicked crave signifies the unrestrained, uncontrolled, greedy appetite of those unwilling to live within the restraints of God's order. Read that again. What the wicked crave signifies the unrestrained, the uncontrolled, greedy appetite of those unwilling to live within the restraints of God's order. So the wicked desire things that are outside of God's realm. And at some point, God intervenes where God puts up blocks that does not allow them to fully grasp that. As you look at verses 2 to 3, there are similarities in them. They form some kind of unit. As you look at there's a chiasm that's kind of a fit here. It's often drawn in the sense of an X, which would be the Greek letter for chi, which is where the concept comes from. And it's saying if you take that, basically it's saying if you take the very first thing and compare it to the last thing, there's a similarity. Likewise, if you take the middle things and compare them, there's the similarities. So if you look at 2a, the beginning, and 3b, the ending of these two passages, so the outer edges, you see that they speak of the wicked. Ill-gotten gains do not profit, 10:3, the very end, but he will reject the craving of the wicked. On the other hand, if you look at the middle two, 2b and 3a, the inner edges, so to speak, it speaks of the righteous. But righteousness delivers from death. The Lord will not allow the righteous to hunger. And so these are kind of grouped together in that way. Both these verses address material possessions. Verse 2 focuses on security of the lives, and verse 3 on the gratification of appetites. Whatever their state, the righteous, you know, are truly, truly happy. Are truly rich, excuse me, not happy. They're truly rich according to these. So ill-gotten gains don't profit, but the righteousness delivers from death, and the Lord does not allow the righteous to go hungry. So there's a richness in, you know, in the righteous. 10:4 says, "Poor is he who works with a negligent hand, but the hand of the diligent makes rich." And once again, we have this chiastic order within this verse. If you notice, it's contrasting poor and rich. The beginning, first word is poor, the last word is rich. And in between, it's the negligent and the diligent. And so those comparisons are made there. This is a general truth that one observes in life. You know, we can observe this in life. Diligent is contrasted with sloth. The diligent, the industrious, the conscientious worker is normally rewarded for his efforts. Now, there may be situations that you can think of or situations you saw and say, well, that's not true. But generally, that's true. Also, the negligent, the lazy worker, does not normally advance, you know, even if he's able to keep his job. There was a guy in Brenham that was one of the most negative people I've ever been around. And he just... you know, he was a very, very different individual to begin with, and he went through this period where he was just very bitter about his job, and I just, you know, was thinking, you know, Bobby keeps this up, Bobby's not going to have a job. And so I called him and made an appointment to visit with him, and he was going to come by the church building when he got off work. And anyway, he called and wanted to know if he could come earlier. Sure, you know, so I met him there. And his first question was, why did I want to see him, and why did I want to see him on that day? And as it turns out, he was convinced that I knew something ahead of time because he had been fired that day. So my pastoral counsel came a little late in the process here to warn him that he was going to lose his job, and he was pretty convinced that Bluebell had already told me ahead of time that they were going to fire him, and I'm not sure why a Bluebell creamies would want to tell me ahead of time they were firing an employee, but it wasn't so much that he was in that sense you know, negligent in the sense of work. He was probably a hard worker. But it's in that sense of where you really become negligent in other areas, perhaps, you know, in the sense of complaint, as opposed to the diligence. And so this contrast that's set there. 10:5 says, "He who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully." The contrast between the industrious and the lazy is in the previous verse seems to be expanded here into a very practical, very specific application. The setting is harvest time. The one who works in the harvest is wise, and the one who ignores it while sleeping acts shamefully. We might have expected there a contrast between wise and fool, that the one who gathers, the one who goes to harvest is the wise son, the one who sleeps is the foolish son, but it moves beyond that to even a stronger one, that this becomes shameful. Because it's not just that he's foolish, this action brings shame upon the family, upon himself and the family. This isn't just some decision, some poor decision. This becomes very serious in an agricultural society. When it's harvest time, you harvest. If you don't harvest, the whole year is gone. And often there's a very short window of an opportunity to harvest. And so here he is, he sleeps. This word for sleep, Old Testament scholar Bruce Waukee says that the phrase, he who sleeps here, denotes a person in a state of sleep that is so deep, traumatic, and narcotic-like that he's totally unconscious of his surroundings. And he compares it to, in Judges 4:21, the same phrase there. And in that count in Judges, you have a guy that is on, this warrior that's fleeing, and he comes to this house, and he's invited in. He goes in the house, and he tells the woman to guard the door, and he goes to sleep in this kind of a sound sleep, and he's oblivious to everything around her. And if you remember the account, she takes a tent peg and a hammer and drives it through his temple. That's being a little too sound asleep. But, and that's the end of his life, because he was... Well, that's the picture here. Somebody that's... It's not just somebody that slept late. It's not... We're not saying, the wise son gets up at 6 o'clock and is out there at daybreak when the sun comes up and starts harvesting. And, the shameful person doesn't get out there until noon. We're not talking about somebody that sleeps late. We're talking about somebody that's just unconscious to the world. Is the idea. Has no concern, no regard, not only for himself or the harvest, but by extension for his family, because this is what provides for him. While this is an agricultural setting, and what's in view here, by application we might say that any opportunity that is not acted on due to laziness. So if there are opportunities and you just don't, you're not aware, you don't act on them because it's too much work, you're just too lazy, you're asleep in this regard, then it would fall in the same thing. Well, verses 4 and 5 also relate to one another. 4a and 5b, once again, the beginning and the end, align poverty due to negligence, sleep, and shame, whereas the middle two, 4b and 5a, align wealth due to diligence, work, and wisdom. So that's what we often see in the Proverbs, is even though the Proverbs are separate Proverbs, they're beside one another and they form a couplet where the first line relates to the last line or parallels it, and the middle two lines somewhat parallel one another. Well, let's look at all, kind of review all of them together and think about them. Through these five verses, there's a highlighting of diligence of the wise son who brings joy, and this is contrasted with contrast this righteousness to the wickedness observed in the fool who brings shame by way of his either immoral pursuits or his laziness. Parents, based upon these passages, we need to teach and model diligence and righteousness. When we fail to do this, we fail to parent godly. Having said that, there's also this place of showing patience as parents. So it's not that we need to have inappropriate expectations of kids at the wrong ages. So not expecting a six-year-old to have the same responsibility as a 16-year-old. But there is this, this teaching responsibility and having that mindset that, the goal of parenting is to teach your children to become responsible adults. So the child that does this is wise and a joy to the parents. The child that doesn't is foolish and is a grief to the parents. Parents who fail to teach their children suffer grief and public shame often. But we need to be careful about not pulling certain verses out and making proof text of them either, to support our positions that aren't really biblical positions whatsoever. So the issue about sleep, for instance, it's not here that a son that sleeps too much, but it here is one that ignored all responsibility for sleep. So, to take this passage and say, you got to be up when the sun comes up and, you got to follow my schedule, wouldn't necessarily be what this passage is teaching. And so there's some things to think about that. It's interesting that in recent years there have been some studies that say that teenagers, that the best quality, optimal time of their sleep is in the morning hours when usually we're waking them up. Now, I have some real questions about that. That I'm surely not qualified to resolve, is that truly a physiological thing? That if you did this study around the world, that would always be true, and it's always been true, and we're just now discovering it? Or is that become a cultural thing? That I will take it for granted that the study is accurate, but I'm not sure that if it's just physiologically true of humans, or if it's true culturally, because we get into those settings, and part of that is, maybe you get into those best hours of sleep at when you're 7 or 8 hours into the sleep, and if you don't go to sleep until midnight, then that means it's 8 o'clock when you're sleeping best, as opposed to if you went to sleep at 9 o'clock. So I'm not sure about how that works, but it's not sleeping late is the issue here. Now that you may have to make certain decisions on what that means in your family. But the real issue here about this sleep is a sleep that interferes with responsibility, interferes with, being productive in that regard. And with that, parents in this regard, as we teach and model diligence, hard work, and righteousness, there's a place for recognizing unconditional love. Children need to be loved, as all of us, most when they don't deserve it, or when they deserve it the least. Someone has said, teenagers are the most unlovable when they need to be loved the most. And that's often true for everybody, that we're the most unlovable when what we need is to be loved the most. An application of these verses is that our actions also impact the lives of those around us. So we're not just talking about children, for as adults to realize our actions impact the lives of those around us. So there's many adults whose actions could be described as wise, or that bring honor to the family, or ones that could be described as foolish or negligent that bring shame and grief to their family. So anyway, you have thoughts or insights or questions on these 5 verses here in Proverbs? Good question. I don't know. I mean, to answer that, absolutely. I think they're generally thought of in the sense of observations of life. So I guess my understanding or take on that would be that not so much that it was just inherently known by him through, this gift of wisdom, so he inherently knows these things, but that ability to observe life and make comparisons You know, a lot of these things aren't startling to us at all. They, you know, when we hear them, we read them or something, they just seem to make, I mean, they seem to be so so obvious, you're almost wondering why somebody writes them down. On the other hand, you know, it takes somebody that's pretty skillful to write them down in those kind of succinct order. Yeah. But, you know, when you know, and most of it is Proverbs. There's some later on that are attributed to other writers, and so it is a collection from other people also, but the majority of them seem to be attributed to Solomon. But I think it's in that sense of general truths that are observed from life. These are generally true, and you can observe from life. I mean, we can generally, I mean, even for us, we can generally, you know, conclude that, you know, if you have financial gain that's obtained immorally or illegally, that the pleasure that one gains from it is going to be short-lived. I mean, now, are there people that apparently never get caught or don't get caught for 30, 40 years? Yeah. But more often you hear about people that are caught very quickly. Or other things. There was an article in the USA Today over the weekend that said that in several cities where murder rates are on the rise, that it's criminals killing criminals. That's, you know, when they look at the people that are doing the killing, the people that are getting killed, that most of them have multiple arrests or convictions, and a lot of it was gang related, that they're in gangs. So just in the sense of, does that mean that everybody that gets murdered therefore is, you know, has a criminal record, or is therefore, you know, was involved in something that was wrong? No, not at all. But, you know, there might be places where you can make some general statements. And it's kind of like the old adage that, you know, I guess if there was going to be a proverb that Solomon wouldn't have written because they didn't have electric lights, but that you've heard is that, you know, nothing good happens after, and I've heard different time periods. You can put the time period in there, whatever you want to, but, you know, after 1 o'clock, after 2 o'clock, after midnight, whatever, nothing good happens after that time. Well, that's a generalization, but it's a generalization for a reason, because it's generally true. And that's when you hear about, you know, all these things. And sometimes, you know, the guy that was at played for the Denver Broncos, that was a graduate of Oklahoma State, I don't remember his name, that was killed last year in almost a drive-by shooting, though he was in his limousine. It was late at night or early in the morning, whichever. I mean, apparently he did nothing wrong. You know, he didn't cause this. He didn't invite this attention or anything. But generally speaking, if you're not in those places, you don't have those same repercussions. So that's not to make the judgment against and say the person was wrong, but it gives you these generalizations. So I think it's in that regard that a very wise man had the God-given ability to observe truth, general truths in life. I think it would be the way.